say, let's get on with the life world and forget about the system for a couple of days. So it's my huge pleasure to introduce Victor Yukegbo to everyone here. Of course, Victor has been the supervisor of two of you who are in this room, and has supervised other PhDs during his time here, so he's certainly no stranger to Northampton. And for many years, Victor used to put on the most marvellous plays. I remember going to one just after I came here, and to a conference that he ran on, Interculturalism and Theatre, with some really prestigious Abe Odum Jafu?
Shofisa.
Yeah, some really prestigious speakers, and it completely opened my eyes to what interculturalism was about. So Victor has for many years worked here as Associate Professor of Theatre and Performance, and in his research he's really put black, British and African theatre on the map. He runs a journal. You haven't mentioned the name of the journal, but Victor, what's it called?
African Performance Review.
The African Performance Review, which I think both Nadia and Chris have been associated with. And he's also worked more locally with performers and other people from the community here in Northampton over the years, building up their culture, putting on plays. I think it was an oral address, wasn't it, that was performed on the radio just last year. So Victor's been very active both in the community and in the university. And we were very sorry to see him go, but absolutely delighted to welcome him back. I'm very much looking forward to his talk, which is called Gems in Unusual Places, Making the Best of Your Research Framework. So, Victor.
Thank you very much, Janet. Thank you, Steve. And good morning and welcome, everybody, to this conference. First of all, I want to say it's a privilege being invited back, you know, to be a part of this conference today. And I know that technology has never been my strong point, and it's already playing up. But I would say, just give me 2 minutes and I'll get my system run. I don't know why it's not showing up here. But in order to frame what I wanted to say this morning, is the fact that Steve has already started by telling us about the interface between society and the systems. And I think we live in a very different environment compared to what I used to know about 10 years ago. There have been huge changes within academia. There have also been huge changes in terms of what government expects and what kind of systems that have been put in place to get things working. So this morning, my desire will be to tease out some of the experiences of what it means to be a researcher who have once been a research degree student, and who is now supervising PhD students who are also researchers in themselves. And I want to do that by giving the, taking illustrations from my own experience of working with PhD students and then working with colleagues, and how through, by going through the entire research process, and I think when I say research process or research framework, I mean that no matter where we start our research, inevitably, we come back to going through the same framework that our process that has already been in existence. So I'll stop there and let me try and get my listen on. I don't know what's going on here. Okay. I've got two USBs. Let me try another one. When you're like me and you're never sure of what technology will throw at you, I think it's always best to. Do you want to continue? No? Right. So technology is still working.
Everybody breathes a sigh of relief.
So I think I would like to explain the background and rationale for the choice of topic and then the approach I have adopted for this keynote presentation. I have framed it on three related premises. Some may say that these premises are my own assumptions, or they may be theories somewhere, but however they are viewed, they reflect something of the individual ideas, views, and thought processes we generally associate with the term hypothesis. So the first premise or hypothesis is that the hope of every research degree student is to engage effectively with his or her research and to conclude the studies or investigation successfully. And I believe that's what every research degree student wants to see. The second one is that research degree supervisors also want the same thing for their students. They want that engagement to be a real encounter, a real interaction, and they want to see them successful. The third premise is that what constitutes a successful outcome of research, whether it is research conducted by students or by supervisors who engage their research, it differs according to disciplines and context and how appropriate the methodologies employed have been. So for this reason, I hope that in my presentation this morning, I will retrace some of the things that are very familiar to us. I wonder if there's anything that's going to be new or unique that you've never had before. But I'm hoping that in tracing and going through this familiar terrain, that we could be able to trace or begin to understand some of the things that impact upon research degrees and upon our own research itself. And so some of these things, you know, whether they are patterns, whether they are paradigms or methodologies, they do cut across disciplines. In other words, while it is possible to start a research in some fields with a subject or a topic, it is also possible to arrive at that point from elsewhere. How many of us are used to the idea of I'm going to do a piece of research, but I need a topic first of all? I have been in that terrain before. It's also possible that you may have started your research before your topic jumps at you. In fact, it's possible that you may have gone some distance in a different direction and something touches you and says, oh, that's not what I should be doing, I'm going back. And yet, the idea of research topic is a very important one. Having said this, the way research is defined by different disciplines, by institutions, by funding organizations, and end-user organizations is a significant factor in how researchers identify their topics, how they investigate their subject matter, and how they conduct their research or design it, or design their methodologies. So in a similar vein, there is no single definition for research. A lot of us have read books on research, not Plath and Brown in my area. We read from Susan Drinkwater in a practice-based research. And each of these books talks about what is research. But if you take the time to read three of them together, you discover that while they have some commonalities, there are also divergences and differences. Because each of them has chosen to define research either from a contextual basis or from a methodological basis. However, despite the different definitions, one of the commonalities of research is that research is not only about what researchers do and why, it's also about the integration of the why into the how. The integration of the why into the how. A purpose and process approach that, especially in the arts and in the works of Bogdov, 2006, distinguishes research in the arts from research into the arts and research on behalf of the arts. Research in the arts, research into the arts, and research on behalf of the arts. And this particular three distinctions, taxonomy that Bogdov has produced, I consider it as processual. in the sense that without stating it, the classification is indicative of a methodology and makes subtle hints at process. Since definitions can in general be prescriptive and limiting, and this is me arguing, and that's an argument I've held for a long time now, at least we have seen from examples of how to choose a topic and what is research. So my main aim in this presentation is to use a number of selected definitions from different contexts to interrogate extents to which ostensibly mundane conditions can offer researchers and research students great scope for making the best of their research framework by drawing extensively but not exclusively on my experience from a recent concluded research that led into a credited publication, Reverberations Across Small-Scale PG Theaters. And that's it here, which was published by Intellect. So the question is, how did we come to this? And I do hope that my desire today is, so in talking about what is research and what the research paradigms and everything or research framework, by walking through this framework and linking it with what we did, myself and my colleague, Dr. Patrick Duggan, who is not here with me today, how we, by following a well-set-out research framework, arrived at a product, the result we are looking for. Evidences from different organizations and the experiences of research degree students and supervisors and other scholarly publications we've seen suggest that while many factors have been considered in order to determine what constitutes research and its framework in any discipline, let us look at how the Arts and Research Degrees, Arts and Humanities Research Council define research. AHRC, the UK, is the highest funding agency for the arts. And this is its definition of, in terms of its own definition for research. It says it must define a series of research questions, issues or problems that will be addressed in the course of the research. It must also define its aim and objectives in terms of seeking to enhance knowledge and understanding relating to the question, issues or problems to be addressed. Now, this is what the AHRC look at. Those are the things that are important to them when they fund research. And the fact that it says it must define a series of research questions. How many of us who have gone through the system or who are still going through the system now have a research degree or a PhD based on a series of questions? There may be a question, there may be a series. It's also possible that there's no single question, but there is an issue or a subject. Now, this is how this interface of life and systems produce some, even though it is a happy conjunction, produce some challenges that task the minds of researchers, research degree administrators, research supervisors. It goes on to say that it must specify a research context for the questions, issues or problems to be addressed. Yes, I do share that view that it must establish a research context. And also go on to say why it is important that these particular questions, issues or problems should be addressed. What other research is being has been conducted in this area? It's a moment for us to think the works that we've done in the past, have they all answered the question as to why it is important for a particular question to be answered? Sometimes, how far do we go in addressing or understanding what other research, and I think PhD students recognize that as literature review, what other research has been done in the area, and how far do we go down that path? There is a pragmatic approach where some research degree students zero in on literature that is related to their subject. But from experience, I doubt, and from experience of this publication, whether that is the most appropriate way to go. It might be good to start from the literature that addresses your topic or your subject very well. But there's also the opportunity to look outside of that literature, find related links and communications, and it begins to enrich the work you're what you're working on. It is important to specify the research methods for addressing and answering the research questions, issues, or problems. And I believe that no research can be worth its name in salt or gold without addressing the question of God. And it seems to me that from this particular definition, some piece of writing do not qualify as research. And some research that are published, because they have failed to meet all these descriptions by AHRC, may not be acceptable to AHRC as research. And I don't know who has had that experience in the past, but I know of people who have applied for funding, and AHRC has come back to tell them to tease out the research questions much more fully. And I've read the application, I said, but I can see the research question very clearly. Why can't they? So there are issues here. And so the AHRC goes on to say, our primary concern is to ensure that the research we fund addresses clearly articulated research questions, issues, or problems. So you may not have questions, you may have issues or problems that you want to look at. And it's set in a clear context of other research in that area. And I think this is where researches that are conducted by the universities differ from researches that are conducted probably by companies or organizations who have no direct link to academia. The need for us as researchers to situate our research within the context of what has happened within the area. If we are going to expand knowledge in that area, if we are going to challenge what is happening, if we are going to take out some theories and some practical techniques or examples and tease them out, we cannot do that in isolation. We must also use an appropriate research method and our approaches. Without all of this, we may need to look at what we are writing again to see whether it's satisfied, whether it sits down as research. So some of those difficult questions that supervisors have had to ask their students, or students have struggled with when supervisors ask them and say, what is the research imperative, research paradigm that sets this work aside from any other piece of writing? It's absolutely necessary that in an era when research is no longer based on our desires alone, it's also driven by institutional requirements. It's also driven by government requirements, because there's a closer relationship in terms of why the government wants to tap into the knowledge base in the universities. So some of the policies that drive what we do in the universities, like REF, like impact assessment, like all these things happen right now because government is keen that with all the money that go into universities, that there should be the generation of capital out of the university, and government wants to tap into it or wants to exploit it for the good of society. So government makes rules that will make research accessible, available, and relevant within the societies. So there is a gradual shift from interest-only research, which, if I remember very clearly, in his first address when he came to this university, Professor the Vice Chancellor, told us in the main hall over there that indulgent research may be a thing of the past. The research that you conduct because you're interested in it, nobody else is interested in it. It may not even have a well-established field, but you're simply going ahead and you do it over years and years and years and years, and suddenly it becomes something. The fact of the relationship this interfacing of government as an institution and university and life itself means that that luxury does no longer exist. And so we have to anticipate that our research, as of necessity, has to have an impact or has to be related or interconnected with whatever is happening in society. Then the ASAS concluded and said the precise nature of the research question, issues or problems, approaches to the research and approaches of work may vary considerably, embracing basic strategic and applied research. Applied, some of us may not be doing applied research in the way the word applied, you know, is used. But there's also an extent to which you can look at whatever research that you do that has an impact on something or some institution or some context in society is drawing upon that applied context one way or the other. It may not set out to do that, but somehow the point is to embrace that. This is another definition from Pearson Prentice Hall. Now, Pearson Prentice Hall claims to be the largest education provider of resources in the universe. And then they say that research is a systematic process of collecting and analyzing information to increase our understanding of the phenomenon under study. It is the function of the researcher to contribute to the understanding of the phenomenon and to communicate that understanding to others. This is very precise, and you can believe that this is coming from an educational institution because it highlights the key things. It is systematic. There is the evidence of what you do, collecting and analyzing information or data of any kind. But you, as a researcher, you do have a role, a function. It is not simply to generate words. How does your work contribute to the understanding of the phenomena that you're talking about? And how do you communicate that understanding to others? So it is possible that some good research have gone on, have happened elsewhere, but they have not been communicated. Is that possible? Is it possible that as a research degree student, you are doing some very good research, but you are struggling to communicate that? And so we lose the impact or the significance of that research. So this is another definition, which this one comes from the Center for Applied Research and Innovations. And they claim that research is to purposely and methodically search for new knowledge and practical solutions in the form of answers to questions formulated beforehand. This suggests to me that while this may apply very well in the social sciences, where there is a problem, you formulate you respond to that by formulating a question, and then you go after it. It is one form of research, and it's not the only way of research. But that kind of research lends itself to applied context more than to the kind of literary backgrounds or literary situation that we work in, where our desire may not necessarily be to solve a problem, but our desire may generate a different strategy for reading and understanding what is happening within our world. And so all these definitions from different places suggest one thing, that research and the work and what researchers do is at best contextual. It might be, it might be framed by a cultural or social context or a disciplinary context in which it's operating. Yet there are, from those different definitions, commonalities of practice, commonalities of interest, and commonalities of form that we cannot escape from, no matter how much they differ with the city of this one. I'll give a last one. Now, this is the one I'll necessarily not recommend to my students from Oxford Concise Dictionary. Not because I don't like it, but simply because I think that this kind of definitions are very generalized. And they are the ones that are much more prescriptive. But I've chosen it, for this, for a particular reason. It says it's a systematic investigation into and study of materials, sources, in order to establish facts and reach new conclusions. In the arts and humanities, we may study materials. We might look at sources, but that is not the only thing that we do. It says it is an endeavor to discover new or collate old facts by the scientific study of a subject or by a course of critical investigation. Our study may not be scientific. Yeah, it is not, our discipline may not be scientific in its approach or in what is, or the subject may not be scientific itself. But that does not mean that it does not subscribe to the concept of the critical investigation that goes on. Because if we are all involved in qualitative, or some of us are involved in qualitative analysis, one way or the other, you have to investigate critically all the information and resources are available to you. So what do, so on the basis of these definitions, what can we make, you know, we draw the following conclusions. Research is activity. So it's on the basis of these four definitions from four different sources that I read this. I said that research is activity researchers do when they have a question to answer, a problem to resolve. Sometimes researchers may think they already know or have answered to a specific question. So why not prove it? And here I want to pause in terms of, and let us go back to our own experiences as society degree students. Are there areas of our research that we thought that we knew the answers to and eventually discovered we didn't? From my own anecdotal experience when I was a research degree student, three major authors had written about an experience which I was looking at. And my supervisor said, you don't need to look at that because it's already well published, it's already known. I said, okay, that's fine, I don't need to look at it. So I didn't bother going into the field. So I simply quoted Simon Ottenberg's work on the Ottenberg performance in AFI because he had lived within the community for 30 years. From 1959 to 1987, he had a home in the community, he lived there, he was an anthropologist, settled in this part of Nigeria, and had lived there for 33 years. So by the time he published his book, the book was, he had lived there, he had this experience. He had his children there, his wife, so he knew he was part of the community. And one of the things he said in that, in the book, was the fact that when this performance is about to take place every 7 years, there is a secret formula that is passed on within the community that people know what is going to happen, and they know precisely when this ceremony will take place. So if he had published it, my supervisor felt he had done it. My lecturers in university said he had done it. So it became a common convention that every person knew that there was this secret communication system in Afibo, in Nigeria, where people know what is going to happen in every 7 years. But out of sheer curiosity, I wanted to go to see the performance myself. And so I was invited, and I go to see the performance. So at the end of the performance, the first day of the performance, I spoke to the community elder, the monarch, the chief of the community. And I said, Simon wrote this about this performance. And now there's Christianity everywhere. Does the performance still operate through that secret system of in communication? How does it work? And he laughed. I said, well, what do you mean? So luckily I had Simon's book, so I opened it up and I said, this is what Simon. He said, Simon Clone Rider. Simon has lived there for going to 40 years now. I said, no, but this is what they eat. They said, I brought this book back from the UK. And even as an undergraduate, 40 miles down the road, this is what we believe. I said, but you never came as an undergraduate, you didn't come to this community, even though you knew that there was this happening. I said, but it has been established that this is what happened. He said, nothing like that happens. I said, then what does happen? How do people go? He says, well, there is a particular music that everybody who is born in this community knows. The moment that music is played, people begin to count the dates from that night. And it takes what he called the 7 Igbo market weeks, which is 28 days. The moment you hear the music, count from that day, on the 28th day, the performance will happen. And everybody who has had the music played will know when, where to come to and when to come to. But for an outsider, for Simon Otemba, who had lived within the community, it was like magic. And yet, it's not magic. It's the reality of the people's, of the people's situation. So sometimes, even hard facts that we've come to take as fact can yield, you know, the most surprising of things. And so when I thought about gems in hidden places, the discovery of that information kept me for another day. And I discovered more that that music actually meant that tonight we audition for the best female dancer. But it's not actually a female dancer. The audition for the best man who can play a woman in a mask. I said, but how does the music, you know, tell all this? I said, but the music, that every person knows about what that music is about. So all the male dancers who are very good, whenever they hear that, every person shows up 4 days from that night. And according to the information I got, I didn't see this happen. The last one they did prior to my going to see the play, there were about 87 men who claimed they could dance and confused the audience that they were actually women, not men. And I've seen the performer, I believe it was a woman until I saw him on mask. So the kind of skills that go on there, you know, because there was a lack of research. So, you know, Simon probably took the information he got, but he did not pursue that. So sometimes, as social degree students, it is difficult for us to, I mean, we need to be able to look at information on the surface and go beyond it. So I'm arguing that without subjecting a problem, ideal hypothesis to rigorous scrutiny, any kind of scrutiny, our knowledge of the subject or activity remains little more than guesswork, at best, an opinion or intuition. I think for Simon, this was intuition. And this was based on what he had felt, because he had lived there for 34 years by the time he wrote this. But beyond that intuition, there was something much more. So once we have we've had that. So what do we do? And here I'm going back to the example of vibrations again. So we have to design a research plan. And a plan consists of a definition of a problem, a plan and process. And I think that defining the problem consists of the following components. The goal of the research. What outcome do we want to achieve with the research? The research question. Tackling the problem and the knowledge we need to achieve this. So based on what we experienced, and let me give you an idea, the reverberation did not start as a direct research. It came out of the process of a meeting when we, the subcommittee of the Division of Performance Studies, held a meeting to decide how do we energize the research environment that will incorporate what our undergraduate students study, not just for us lecturers. And in that meeting, we decided that we will invite key theater practitioners to come in and do showing of work. So the plan was to establish a framework that will allow practitioners, we'll select practitioners, and the six of us who were there, each person selected about 3 practitioners. We've got 18 practitioners, companies to invite. So we'll invite one of them to become resident here in the university, and then use the main hall, the studio, and then every month there'll be a showing of work. And that showing of work will be done by professionals who come from their own companies, so we can share work. Soon it became obvious to us that some of these companies we were inviting were older than 10 years old, were more than 10 years old and running. Some Red Ladder have been in existence for more than 30 years. Tara has been in existence for more than, to go into 40 years. So, and then there was Paper Birds, which had just been formed by students who came out of University of Leeds. It was 2 years old at the time. So are there any things that make this thing, that is there any commonality, any common experience with these companies? Some 40 years old, some 2 years old. So our discussion moved on from there into, are we going to show this work just as a showing, or what is it, research, or is it not research? And then out of that, we also, so we came to the conclusion that one of the companies that we wanted to bring in was going to charge us £4,000 for a show. Lone Twin. Now, that was what they would charge to do the show. But we had to fly them from Australia, where they were working at the time, to come over, and then pay them £4,000. And I knew then, and I said, Steve won't say yes to this. He's going to tell me that that's going to blow the budget. So we began to think again, what do we do? Their work is definitely interesting. These other companies who are working on are definitely interesting. So where do we go from here? So we thought, okay, let's, instead of inviting the companies, let us invite the practitioners from the companies to come and do an interview so they can talk to our students. But what will our students be talking to them about if there's nothing to show? We say, okay, we know how to do this. Let us get a recording of their work, play it for our students in advance of the time, and then they'll come in on a day, so we can pay them for one day travel and everything, and then they have an interview. And so one of the members of the committee said, it's not going to work because it's going to be recorded. How are you sure? Why don't we bring something live? What about a workshop? So we moved away from there. Actually, the best thing would be to do a workshop. Bring them in, they do a workshop with our students. Our students take on some of the ideas and put into their work. And then somebody mentioned, but is that work is still contained within the university? If it's research, shouldn't it be going outside of the university? Or why are we doing this actually if it is not research for us? Are we confusing, you know, academic activity with actual research activity? So we began to have series and series of meetings. By the time we concluded what we were doing and where we were, a year had gone by. So the budget, whatever we have for that one, is already gone. And so the idea of us as researchers working and talking with these practitioners and companies and then conducting the interviews ourselves and publishing the interviews backed with critical research on their work and on the interviews. And they said, oh yeah, that makes sense. But how are you going to do it? And so for one simple question, a lot of issues began to emerge. Very many issues we hadn't planned. So we began to think of how we are going to design it. How are we going to work on this research? So we thought about a particular plan. So okay, let it be between us and those companies. So the companies offer us information, offer us access to their archives, to their library resources. We go in and research, and then we interview them based on what we have discovered. But can we do that without taking on board what else has been written about these companies and what they do? So the research journey, which started from a very simple framework and very clear to us as to what we wanted to do, has evolved like a hydra with so many tentacles, but we needed to rein in these tentacles and find ourselves a framework. So our topic began to change. Our method began to change. Our approach began to change. What we could possibly do began to change. But more importantly, there was a question as to why. why? Why do we want to do it? So we go back to AHRC. AHRC said that we have to justify or prove that the reason for doing this research is important to the body of knowledge. And we discovered that, yes, it is important because all these companies have existed in Britain since 1950. They have all done their little things in little areas, in different areas, each of them issue-based. But none of them have spoken across to each other before. There is no publication anywhere that suggests they have spoken to each other. So our starting premise, which was get them all together to share work, has changed, but we're still getting them together. This time we'll get them together. They won't get themselves together. We'll get them together through critical investigation of their work and cross-referencing of the work that was going on. So even though the principle remained the same, the approach was beginning to change. And so in designing the topic, you know, and responding to the topic and designing what would be appropriate, our topic moved from sharing performance experience to extensive collaborations. I've said, no, there's no collaboration happening here. To the static interface. So, well, they don't talk to each other, so where is the interface going to happen? And so we thought that we were going to negotiate that interface through how we bring them together in our work. Therefore, going one step beyond what the companies have always done, which is bringing work together and mapping them across to see what are the relationships between these companies. And why did some of them fail? And why are some of them still going on? Why do we have new ones that have started and are suddenly doing very well, like Pepper Birds, which is made up of three girls, and yet Magdalene Project in the Wales, in an island in the 1980s, have just gradually gone on the radar. What is happening? So there were a lot of information, a lot of things we wanted to do, which we thought was necessary for us. So from researching our topic and having all those discussions, we decided that there are certain things we need to, how are we going to approach this research? And of course, there are many types of research from qualitative point. There are so many of them. But I think in order to link this discussion to the project that we did, I've just cited three different kinds of research that informed our work. Before then, we had decided, what were the defining aesthetics of different companies? Those are the questions we were going to ask ourselves. How did they develop them? Where are the companies now? Why did some survive and why others did not? How did funding and politics factor in the work and survival of otherwise of these companies? Could these companies, given the artistic vision and issue-driven work, be described as British? Tara was doing work that was about Southeast Asia. Tamara was doing work that was about Bangladesh area. Talawa was doing work about Black British. But out of that Black British, there was a split. Fadosi began to do work for West African Black British, different from Caribbean Black British. And so with all this kind of sectional nationalism and cultural nationalisms, could this work actually be spelled as British? If they were British, where was the Caucasian, the Welsh, the Scottish, the English element in this piece of work? And so we began to redefine our concept of small issue theater. We began to redefine our concept of Britishness. If they are not British, what are they? Are they African, Asian, or any kind of European? Terminologies of people or cultural groups in that themselves raise very tasking questions for us. And so that was how we came up with the idea and said that we're going to talk about reverberations, the things that happen across all these small black budget theaters, one thing that happens when they all work individually, that we can feel happening elsewhere, or that we can feel happening even after the theaters companies have come and gone. And so the idea of the activity, the action that, you know, that follows the works of these companies became the focus of our work, of our research. So it has moved a little away from researching the companies into researching the impact or the effect of the companies on the British society and on the British cultural landscape. So the idea of a topic, you know, or the idea of a subject matter was never fixed. It was like a kind of loose situation that kept evolved over the time, but retained its spine all through the period. The spine never changed. But the way it came across, the way it was presented, the way it was articulated, changed in relationship to what we were discovering as we were conducting the research. So these are the three kinds of research approaches that we use in conducting that work. We looked at the fundamental type of traditional research, and then we moved on, and we thought that this traditional research can only be developed in the concept of using an empirical system. I think probably people might want to ask me questions at the end of the day. What are the differences between fundamental and traditional? I think fundamental traditional is the usual kind of research where we explore an idea, a subject, and we publish it, or we articulate it in writing, in a dissertation, in a thesis. And then there's also the practice-based research, which is more or less a combination of the two, practice. There's a practical element. But how you use the practical element decides whether it is practice-based or whether it is practice as research. And that is a longer argument, so I'm trying to avoid that. Long argument has been raging in this continent for many years now. And then, of course, there is action research. Action research is the one that seems to appeal to a lot of artists. And I think that is what is something that, for my own discipline area, where I know that practicing dancers, actors, stage designers do practice on their work in order to improve the work. So part of the research goes back to what Bogdov says about art in, art for, art on behalf of. And action research, it is, again, the terminology is one that people in social sciences and in education in particular have colonized. They have taken it over as their main piece of work. And a lot of people who go on into education research start off from the concept of action. What is not going on right? What are the challenges? And they take it on. But it is also the domain of people in the performing arts. Some of my colleagues, their PhD was about acting. It was about using particular processes in developing actor training. So why did they do that? Probably they were working in the industry. They knew something was amiss. They decided to pursue what was amiss. And then they decided that the best thing was to engage in actor training that worked off neuropsychological basis, and using it as a basis of reinterpreting old existing techniques of acting. But at the time, we were all working with the same techniques. But somebody thought that we needed to revise or reinvent those techniques. So action research lends itself very much to that process. So the next question is, how do we develop our research? So I'm looking at the empirical system, and this is the empirical system, which is what a lot of us do, which is we identify the research problem, we do a literature review, we define the problem, we have a research plan, we collect our data, we analyze it, we write it up, we evaluate the research, and it's ready for publication of a second examination. The question, going back to my topics, at what point in this kind of system, where do you begin your research? A lot of people say you begin with identifying your research question. That may be somebody's approach, but another person might come another way. Somebody might actually be collecting data on something and discover something else, and that becomes the starting point of your research. My argument is that there are no hard and fast rules as to where to research, where to start, when to start. It is to be able to identify that once you started, you cannot continue or finish without returning to a framework. You cannot escape the framework. I mean, it is like the story I tell my students from time to time about the six blind men who went to see the elephant. You know, each person had a problem. So the first one touched the trunk of the elephant and said, "Oh my God, the elephant is very much like a snake." Yeah, very correct. The other person touched the feet of the elephant and said, "Verily, verily, I say, the elephant is like a tree trunk." Appropriate from where he stood and from what he felt. The other one touched the ears of the elephant, and the elephant at that point decided to fan himself. Said, "Oh, yeah, I do know. The elephant is very much like a big fan." One touched, his body and said, "Oh, no, the elephant is not, it's a wall. We can't get it to move. It's a wall. Just stretch your hand. It's a wall." One touched the tail of the elephant and went about singing, "The elephant, verily, it's like a whip." So each person had an idea. But it's by bringing all these pictures together that we know, those of us who see, rather than the blind men who want to do this, know that elephant is actually a combination of all six, not one. And sometimes research can be looked at in that respect. You may have started from somewhere, but before you end it as research, you've got to embrace all the other parts of what constitutes research. So you may have started with an idea that does not have a question, but by the time you finish, a question would have been raised that needs to be addressed. You may have started by agreeing everything that you see, but somewhere along the line, you challenge ideas. You have to pursue those ideas that you challenge. So the empirical system starts with the identification of a problem, which is the normal thing, defining a subject. And it is important for researchers to be interested in the subject matter, because if you're not interested in the subject matter, you can't do it. And once we identify the research problem or research question or research subject, it is possible for us to go through all of these areas. We cannot arrive at writing from identification of problem, we have to go through some systems. We cannot get to collect data and everything and avoid review of literature. What you've collected, what are you going to do with it? And so there is a degree to which a good research is one that not only touches and addresses them, but that ties them up in this kind of research, this empirical cycle research. And it doesn't matter what area of art or humanities you are working from. That research, to qualify, to answer to the remits of what a research is, must address always. Yet, it's an approach that some people might find easy to use. Other people might find other ways and go for that styles. Okay, so the next one I want to talk about is the practice-based research. Now, this is one that appeals to me a lot in the sense that this is one I'm used to in my area, where we look at practices or theories or the practice of theory, or where we look at a practice and want to theorize it. What is it that makes this happen? And then this particular approach, consists of several phases. And it's quite a complicated, image or diagram, but I'll share it all the same. So here, no. So the three phases, I'll identify three phases. Phase one is the problem or question is analyzed, so which is the first part. Problem diagnosis. And here we cannot escape with the from the relationship between theory and practice, and you see it's central to what goes on there. So we collect our data, we analyze it, we reach conclusions. Then as we reach conclusions, the purpose is not just to reach conclusions. Design a new practice. So the research on the practice is aimed at furthering the practice, not necessarily to confirm it. You may think that this is not happening for people who are in fundamental traditional research. They say, no, I'm not doing this practice element. Somewhere at the back of it, what you are doing is based on this relationship between practice and theory. I know one of two PhD students, one of them is looking at Nigerian drama and theater. But a lot of the things that she's talking about comes only out of performance. And so even though it is not a practice-based PhD, the practice is integral in terms of developing the argument and investigating the hypothesis that she's working from. In the process, there's always opportunity to change. And all I've said is that things are not fixed, they're not concrete. There's always this opportunity, moments of change. So at the time you are designing a new practice, you're thinking about something changing or implementing the new practice. Somebody who goes to through practice as research, you look at a company like Fontic Assembly, and you look at what they do, and you discover there is something that they don't do, or there is a technique that is making this work difficult. What do? You discover that technique, and a new technique is born. So practice as research generates a lot of the time new ideas in relationship or in response to practice. And again, I buy into Bogdov's taxonomy that this is art research, art-based research, on behalf of, or in the service of, or in. So for those of us in the arts, we need to look at when we do research, or one of those of Bogdov's taxonomies comes into place one way or the other. But it's not something we are always very conscious of. It is something that happens there. So in the divine phase, the divine phase, which is phase two of this particular approach, the blueprint, that is your ideas as a practitioner, you concretize it and then you begin to implement it and try it. And I know students who have gone out to the field, found something, come back to the studio and begin to do things. Does it work or does it not work? But even that blueprint is subject to change in the process of research. For instance, you find something new that you didn't know existed before. Just like I discovered that the beautiful dancer in the Okombo dance is not a woman, it's actually a man. Even in the community, they say, we are looking for the best female dancer. What I didn't understand at the time was that when you say you're looking for a best female dancer for this performance, that is male dominated. What they are saying is that we're looking for the best actor, or best person, best male performer who can perform as a female. So it is insufficient to say I can perform as a female. It is much more for them that you are so convincing that visitors to the community think that is a woman. And I remember seeing a 1947 article written by an anthropologist that says that in that particular performance, this is the one performance in Igbo land where a woman masked. It is not a woman, it's a man who has studied all the mannerisms and does it very well. So this is for practice-based research. So in phase three of the practice, you now perform your new idea, you put it on board, put it in action, and I think Sally, when your team came over here at the theater to perform, your research team, You know, so we saw what you had discovered put into practice. And there was this issue of a questionnaire. Did we as members of the audience identify that? Did we see it? Did it happen for us? So I'll quickly show the next, which is the action research. Action research I've described, but this is what the cycle looks like. It's because so you look, you find a problem, you act on the problem. What do you think of acting on the problem? What do you see? What is it that has happened? So there is the diagnosis, the problem diagnosis. You plan what you need to do, you act on it, and then at the end of the day, you see whether it has worked or not. And that is action research. In arts, there is a lot of that happening. There is a terminology that we don't often see a lot associated with the arts. We see a lot of it happening within the social sciences. So, because I'm conscious of time, the next stages, which I'm not going to talk about, are how you collect your data, which we all know what to do. I'll go straight to the conclusion. And so here, my question is, why did I title this presentation Gems in Unusual Places, Making the Best of the Research Framework? We started Reverberations with a conversation in the then Department of in the Division of Performance Studies. And one of the reasons was to encourage our colleagues, you know, with their research, and we came upon an idea, which at the time was a hunch. For all of us in the department, in the committee, have taught in the past, I have not followed through. We did not have a research topic or plan. We were simply having a conversation. We followed through on an interest and discovered a subject about which something was known and had been written on in good critical fashion, but in a very different fashion. Because before we published this book, all the companies that are written here, other people have written something about the companies. So we're looking for something, a fresh take. Before the vibrations, all publications on small-scale British theatres focused on individual companies and practitioners with very little cross-dialogue happening within and across diverse communities of practice. You may ask me, is the publication groundbreaking? I will say no and yes. No, because it is a contribution to related publications within the discipline. But yes, because of the three very important things that the book does or has achieved, which I think I'm not able to describe, but I think Ben Fletcher Watson, who reviewed this book for the Scottish Journal of Performance, puts it better. And this is what he says. He says, the editors note more than 100 companies were reviewed, but this was whittled down to the final selection. Reverberation, you know, succeeds in eliminating the importance of the contributions of small-scale theaters to the bigger picture of British social, political, and cultural life. In particular, the decision to invite individual scholars to conduct each interview means that the collection reflects the sector's diversity rather than pursuing a single authorial basis, thesis. This rich, fascinating text will hopefully inspire debate within the academy and provide valuable insight into a wide range of companies as Britishness reaches a crossroads. Most fruitfully, those sections dealing with Black, Asian, and minority ethnic companies achieve a merging of the two, reflecting on Britishness, otherness, as a crystallizing mode of practice, springing from what Jatinder Varma calls the margins of dominant discourses. It is here that the book's subtitle, Politics, Aesthetics, and Forms, becomes most fully realized. In other words, Ben Fletcher Watson's statements confirm that Reverberations does what research should aim for and succeeds in doing exactly that. It did not start from a grandiose scheme or topic, but it shows that research can start from anywhere and meet all the frames. Why do I say this? I say in the end, all successful research, no matter how it is defined, whether it started from, where it started from, why it is conducted, and what the result is about, must as of necessity be identified with the following. There is a statement of problem, there is a literature review, there is a choice of research method, the investigation has got to be planned, there is moment of data collection, it was analyzed, and there is a writing up. And that writing up for us is this publication. For you, for research degree students, you also have a writing up. But to get to that writing up, you've got to go through the first six stages, no matter where you started. You have to come to them before the writing up. And on that note, I say thank you very much. Thank you.
Victor, I think your talk speaks to everyone in this room because we're all here having done research in some way, shape or form. Everyone has struggled with a research proposal. We've all struggled with the methodology. And I just, out of the very rich range of areas you covered and the questions you raised, I'll just touch on one, which is your story about how you had to change your methodology or you had to change the direction, because this whole conference is in many ways pitched towards people who are midway through their research and who are going to actually present seminars that are part of the stage called transfer. The transfer seminar is that moment in your research when you're able to look at what you've accomplished so far, the research that you've already done, and ask whether you are still on track. Has the research proposal that you set out a year or so ago remained the same? Are you still looking at the same material? Are you anticipating the same methodology will work? And I think that a number of you here will be going through this scrutiny of your work at this very conference. So thank you very much, Victor. I think we've got time for a couple of questions, if anyone has anything they'd like to ask Victor.
Yes.
You know
that complicated diagram, practices research?
Yes.
Was that your own diagram?
No, it was a diagram I got from a Center for Applied Research and Innovations. And the diagram was designed by, I think it was designed by four scientists, two scientists and two social scientists who worked on it. And one of the things, why the Center for Applied Research and Innovations, you know, loved that diagram, why they recommend it, is the fact that the problems we had in the past between practice and theory, you know, that debate has been resolved, that we cannot do theory that is not backed by practice, or we cannot do practice that has no theory sustaining it. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, they feel that the separation that academia has done in the past, that is now over. That integrated relationship is best worked out when, for us, practice-based research should actually be about advancing practice, but also advancing the methodologies of practice research. And I think that's what we as some students struggle in terms of what is the relation between my practice and my research. Some of them would prefer to do, which is the easier option, go and do your studio work and then write about the studio work. But there's nothing coming back from that studio work that has to do with methodology. And that's a problem. Now, that is where PAR, practice as research, was circled around for a very, very long time. But using that diagram now, we can jump the hoop. We will no longer be interested in whether that argument has been resolved or whether we still need to follow that. We are going to assume that it has been done. There's this practice theory in a relationship, and then we can go on to advanced practice. And one of the things that I found interesting in some of the readings I've done recently about practice-based research is that there is also the embodied nature of this world, that sometimes we cannot speak about it, but we put it into our practice and becomes part of what we do and part of the techniques. And yet those techniques, after a long while, begin to look as if they are talent, but actually learned techniques that we have imbibed and ingested into our own mechanisms of doing things.
Okay. Another question?
Yeah, actually, I just have a comment, not exactly a question from my own experience. It's how research has become more scientific of late. In the past, when we used to do research in the field of literature, it was enough to write to a tradition and how this particular writer is romantic or Victorian or is a combination of the two or whatever. And that was enough, really, to highlight the attributes of the work. And how of late, with all these theories in the field, you have to define your position. And this morning I was telling my students how easy it was, really, for me to do one paper on a post-colonial writer and how the methodology came in naturally. But now with all these methods, are we writing within the feminist literary theory? Are we writing within the post-colonial literary theory? What are we writing in with all these theories coming in the field? So it's really a struggle, even for the most learned and the most experienced researcher to define the methodology has become really a science in itself that challenges ideas, something which we haven't experienced, let's say, 25 years earlier.
Yeah.
I'm just amazed by all this, yeah.
I think that's when Janet thought about how we change our methodology.
Yes.
It factors into that because we started, because the division then, you know, marketed itself as Center for Applied Research.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we, so part of our methodology that it had to be research-based, you know, practice-based. But in terms of practice-based, the five of us who were the committee, none of us was committed to following through the process of inventing a new methodology based on the practice that was happening.
Yeah.
Secondly, we didn't have the space to bring in the support to do the work in the studio. We had other things to do. So that was a consideration that at the back. That's why we thought companies coming in, doing it, then we sit down and then write now. But back to your question, what framework would we be writing? Because the materials, the moment we had one showing we had, or rather we saw on DVD, the moment we thought this was intercultural, as we began to see the work, it was no longer just intercultural. Post-colonialism began to factor, became stronger. And we were sure, oh, this is actually post-colonial. But at the end of the day, there was also the feminist element in it.
If I could just comment, I think it is to do with the greater interdisciplinarity or cross-disciplinarity of our research methods now, so that we are constantly weighing up one approach against another. And it's almost like working with metadata on top of your original text, and different epistemologies, ways of thinking about it that make it much more challenging. Yes?
Maybe it also has to do as well with the sort of neoliberal terror that
yes.
the university in itself is experiencing. There's a struggle for recognition within academia itself, having the research recognized as valuable as the scientific fields.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's necessary for people doing the humanities or liberal arts to step their game up.
Yes.
Have a more scientific
basis. Yes, I think that was another point, a really important point that Victor raised about how research has to matter across the community, and it can't just be sort of curiosity driven. It has to have a kind of relevance. We have to make it relevant, and therefore we have to create a wider range for its referencing. And
in fact, there's a kind of growing, you know, swell in some universities about collaboration between colleagues.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that is no longer about colleagues within the department. It's colleagues across departments, from art and between art and science, social science and humanities, and all those kind of things working together, and even across universities. And the scientific approach for that kind of research to be to satisfy funding organizations and the requirements of the university as an institution, or as institutions, that relationship has got to be forged in both the methodologies, because you're not doing the work alone as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
You have a scientist who's contributing to that.
Yeah.
And the growth of performance studies started with this interfacing of the arts,
yes.
social sciences, and pure science.
Another question from David.
When you talked about the funding bodies, that sometimes I think you have to accept that there needs to be two outputs from your research. The output for the funding body, which addresses a very clearly set of, shall we say, modernist-driven questions that you're going to be researching with these outputs, and perhaps a separate output which is more academic, which might be more postmodernist, which might be emerging rather than having predefined questions that you're going to be researching, and that you produce one research report to give to the funders, and then you produce some academic articles which are perhaps more reflective and more following the emergent things which occurred during the research.
That's absolutely correct, and I think that's what I didn't mention in my presentation, that for us there are two reports. The report on the funding, how the money was spent, went to Janet and Steve. So that didn't show up anywhere. But the academic part of that is this publication which we are looking at. And I think that you're very correct that we have to think strategically as researchers, that while we are addressing the remit of funding agencies, it is much more important that we do not lose sight about what we do in terms of the academic integrity of our work, the research imperative that drives every work that we do.
Well, I think that's quite a good and sobering note to conclude on, the question about funding and the integrity of the research and how we strike that balance. So thank you again, Victor, for an excellent start.